I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. A lot of focus right now on police reforms, body cameras, a new leadership team for Baltimore police, more of a chance for the public to see the evidence against officers accused of misconduct. Are these reforms enough to build public trust in the police in the wake of Freddie Gray's death? In this hour, we'll speak with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis about the, quote, tangible, real progress he says he's bringing to the department. Up first, a Maryland state legislative panel is proposing major changes in police policies. One idea, the panel wants officers to undergo periodic mental health evaluations. Delegate Kurt Anderson, who represents the city and co-chaired the work group, will walk us through the recommendations. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us today. Later in this hour, Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis will join us to talk about how he plans to improve discipline and accountability in the police department. If you have a question for Kevin Davis, you can email it to midday@wypr.org, and we'll be taking calls. Our local number is 410-662-8780. We had planned to spend this first part of the show looking at the police reform initiatives that the General Assembly will take up this session. A work group made up of legislators from both chambers of the General Assembly has proposed nearly two dozen changes to state law and policing standards. It's called the Public Safety and Policing Work Group. It was convened after the turmoil in Baltimore in April. After Freddie Gray was fatally injured in police custody, the work group held public hearings during the summer and fall. It was chaired by two Democratic legislators from Baltimore, the Senate Majority Leader Catherine Pugh and Delegate Kurt Anderson. As you may have heard me say in the billboard, we had expected Delegate Anderson to join us right now from Annapolis, but the perils of trying to talk to legislators during a legislative session is that they have lots of pressing concerns and pressing activities they need to do to represent their constituents. So we don't have Delegate Kurt Anderson with us. We are hoping that his co-chair, Senate Majority Leader Catherine Pugh, will be able to join us soon. There are 22 recommendations. Some of them have to do with the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. For example, that Bill of Rights now allows officers 10 days to obtain legal counsel before they can be questioned in an administrative disciplinary investigation. The proposal that the work group has made is to cut that time in half to allow officers 5 days. Some critics still believe that's too long a period of time, that it's a lot more time than civilians who are accused of misconduct criminally have to respond. And so that's one of the things that we would like to talk to legislators about is why that proposal and what is the outlook, because a similar proposal has failed last year in the legislature. There's also a recommendation that the work group is making to the legislature to open police trial boards to the public. We'd like to know more about why that is. Commissioner Davis in Baltimore is proposing to go partway down that road. He is proposing to live stream at a particular place in the police headquarters to let the public watch police trial boards, not in the room itself where the trial board is taking place, and not putting that stream on the internet for anyone to watch, but basically a limited exposure of the police trial board. So we want to find out more about that, too. The work group also recommends establishing an independent panel, the Maryland Police Training and Standards Commission. And I'm curious as to whether you think that there needs to be that more of a state role in setting training and standards for police. You're welcome to be part of any of this conversation. As I said, our local number is 410-662-8780. We have a toll-free number. If you're calling long distance, you can call toll-free 866-661-9309. And you can send us an email to midday@wypr.org. A lobbyist for the Maryland Fraternal Order of Police told the Baltimore Sun last week that the police union is currently, quote, opposed to any and all changes, close quote. So all of the 22 recommendations that have come from the work group, the Public Safety and Policing Work Group, are something that the Fraternal Order of Police want to debate quite heavily. Oh, my goodness. Commissioner Davis is with us now. Please join us. We're very glad that you're with us. Commissioner Davis has been in charge of the Baltimore Police Department since last July, when Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake fired his predecessor, Anthony Batts. And you were made permanent. You were acting commissioner for a while, and you've been permanent commissioner since?
So, Sheila, you can't forget that confirmation hearing. It was very lively. It was October 14th.
October 14th.
It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, and I really appreciate your being here and being here even earlier than we expected you. Thank you.
I don't do as well as being on time as I used to, but TJ Smith, who's here with me, keeps me on track, and I can't thank him enough for that.
Well, we're glad, and our listeners are glad, because I'm sure that they will have lots of questions for you also. Since I was filling our listeners in on the proposals that the General Assembly is going to be looking at, the proposals that came from the Public Safety and Policing Work Group that was chaired by two Baltimore legislators, let me just at that point ask what your reaction is to their proposals.
Well, I think everyone knows that this is the year where the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights is most likely to be amended, and I've publicly stated on a couple of occasions that I fully support the recommendations that the Maryland chiefs and Maryland sheriffs recently made to the Senate President Miller and Mr. Bush. So that
Speaker Mike Bush.
So we sent that a while ago. I stand behind those. I don't have the recommendations of the group in front of me, but I think this is just a year where we're all talking about LEOBR in a constructive way. And we all want to move forward. It's a law that's been around, I think, since 1974 or so. And not unlike other laws, as time goes by, there's nuances in the profession that require adjustments to legislation.
The news of the day, of course, is that Mayor Rawlings Blake just announced the city has chosen a vendor to outfit police with body cameras. You're actually a little ahead of schedule on that. I think at your press conference last week, you said you expected a vendor to be chosen next month.
Right. It's exciting. And I was glad to stand with the mayor. And the mayor really deserves a lot of credit because, when we went into this pilot program, there were a lot of calls for her to move faster. And the mayor made a very deliberate decision to act with a sense of urgency and not with a sense of haste. And I really applaud what she did with the pilot program, because the feedback from the police officers, and this is how our pilot program is different from other agencies, the feedback that police officers gave was actually scored and made part of the selection process. So in other words, it wasn't just feedback that sat on a piece of paper and became a paperweight. It was actually scored feedback from the 155 cops who participated in the pilot program.
So were they, I'm trying to picture how one scores the feedback. Did you ask officers to fill out a form with particular questions as to how they felt the process of using
variety,
the camera worked?
A variety of questions were used, and then just their generic narrative. It really ease of use. Something as simple as how easy is it to turn on and off? How easy is it to attach to your person? How easy is it for you to tag after you have an encounter with a citizen and you want to capture that date, time, location, and make a couple notes? So all those things were captured, and I think it's the mayor's to be applauded for really taking in the feedback from the police officers.
And the pilot lasted how long? How many?
A couple months. It ended December the 18th.
So along with this very detailed feedback about which kind of camera and how it worked, what is the more general feedback you're getting from those 155 police officers who have already been wearing body cameras about what impact it's having on the way they police and the way the public is reacting to them?
Well, the general feedback is very specific. They love it. And they police officers tell me and they tell others that it has made police citizen encounters better. So once everyone realizes that a camera is on the scene of a police citizen encounter, it makes everybody act differently. And I think it gives everyone pause. And if it gives people pause and if it creates a more civil interaction, then I think it's a win for the community and it's a win for the police department. And it gets us to that better place.
And so what is the rollout? How long is it going to take for every police officer to be wearing a camera?
Well, the announcement yesterday was just the announcement of Taser being selected. And now the process with
as
procurement.
The vendor. Taser as being selected as the vendor.
And so then there's a back and forth with procurement about the pricing of it all. And I imagine that'll take a tiny bit of time. But we anticipate that April will be the month where we train police officers and we begin to distribute the body cameras, and that's exciting. So a lot of folks have asked me, well, which district's getting the body cameras first and how do you decide?
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is whatever number comes in with that first distribution is we're going to divide it by nine, and so we know that all nine of our police districts have body cameras, and then we'll just,
so it's not going to move across the city like a wave. It's going to pop up.
Yeah, everyone needs to get them. So I think, you know, it's easier for us to train officers that way, so we're not taking cops off the street en masse. And it's just a better feeling, I think, folks, no matter where you live in the city, that there will be police officers in your police district that have body-worn cameras.
Well, I think one of the questions some people have is, you know, they look at some of the high-profile police-involved killings in other cities over the past year. And they see that many of them began with routine interactions, like a traffic stop. So they ask, will cameras be on every time police interact with somebody?
Well, not every time, because there are certain interactions we have, for instance, with vulnerable victims of sex crimes. And there are certain interactions that we'll have with witnesses. There are certain conversations that we'll have with people who want to remain anonymous and report something to the police. So there are instances where cameras will not be used. There are instances where cameras are mandated to be used. You know, any official police citizen encounter, for instance, it's mandated use with limited exceptions that I just described. So that's kind of like building this airplane in midair. And we have a policy that exists right now. We're going to amend that policy before we roll out the formal program just to reflect the slight differences that the particular camera will have. But, you know, we're looking to really be a national model. We'll be the biggest department in the country once we get this rolled out to have all of our police officers outfitted with body cameras. So it's not like we're a small department rolling out, you know, 20, 30 or even 100 cameras. It's a big endeavor, and so far so good, and we're doing it thoughtfully, and we're right on target.
And again, the rollout, how long until all
until
of
everyone,
Baltimore's?
So it's slated to happen, and everyone should have one within 2 years.
Now, within 2 years.
It's our goal to have that happen a lot faster than that. And those are some of the conversations that we'll be having with Taser in terms of the distribution rollout and how quickly we can get these cameras in, train police officers, because it's going to take about 8 hours to pull police officers offline to train them. That's an entire day. And then anytime we talk about training mandates, we have to be concerned with the impact that has on public safety on those particular days. So there's a lot of moving parts in this, and it's always not as easy as it looks.
That is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis here on Midday on WIPR. We're going to take a short break now. We're also going to talk briefly when we get back. We'll continue talking with Police Commissioner Davis, and we'll talk with State Senator Catherine Pugh, who is joining us on the line from Annapolis, and get her sense of the outlook for the reforms that the work group she co-chaired, what the outlook is in the General Assembly. We hope you'll be part of our conversation, too. You can call us locally at 410-662-8777. 780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Sheila Cast here. We're talking about police reforms in this hour. Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis is here with me in the studio. And we began the hour talking about the 22 recommendations to the General Assembly for changes in state law and policing standards, the recommendations that came from the Public Safety and Policing Work Group that was convened after the turmoil in Baltimore in April. The co-chair of that group, State Senator Catherine Pugh, who is Majority Leader, has joined us by phone. State Senator Pugh, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Sheila.
So, 22 recommendations. What are you telling your colleagues is the most important?
Well, it's really difficult to say which of the 23 actually that are most important, because we really deliberated over all of these for a period of time. And while we have created an independent agency, the Maryland Police Training Standards Commission, separating it from the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, I think is really important, because it allows there to be focused just solely on best practices, standards, and training in law enforcement, and to create that uniformity in policing practices across the state. I thought that was very important. I think for the community, the discussion around the period of time for retaining an attorney for the internal investigation and disciplinary process under LEOBR was reduced from 10 days to now 5 days. That's the recommendation that will go to the judiciary committees.
And let me hold the rest of your thought, but I do want to ask you about that in particular, because there was a similar recommendation, a similar bill before the legislature last year, I understand.
Yes.
And it failed. Tell me what you think is different now.
Well,
tell me what you think the outlook is.
Well, let me just say, all bills that are filed usually get a hearing, and then they go to these various committees. See, I don't get to see a Judiciary Committee bill unless it gets to the floor, because I'm not on the Judiciary Committee.
Uh-huh.
So neither one of those bills, at least on the Senate side, actually came to the Senate floor, so we didn't get to see those bills. I think what is different this time is that this was a work group that was convened by the Speaker and the President to say, look, you all need to take a look at policing practices across the state and bring us back some recommendations that we can deliberate on. This does not guarantee that either one of these bills will pass, but I think with the weight of the President and the weight of the Speaker, and we had the chairs of the various committees there as well, I think that bodes well for its passage.
I interrupted you. You were telling us some of the other proposals that you think it's important to watch.
For example, there was a requirement for notarizing a complaint. If you want to allege excessive force or a complaint against a police officer, you had to actually go and get it notarized, which sometimes, you know, is beyond some people's affordability. So we lifted that, and so that you're not required to get your complaint notarized at this point. At least that's part of the recommendation. And it's also, we've provided some whistleblower protection should be given for retaliation, so that officers who want to participate in investigations aren't retaliated against. I thought that was also important. It's 23 different recommendations. We opened up the trial boards to the public. We thought that it was important that hearings and those board proceedings be open, so that means that we will have to lift the statutory prohibition against citizens' participation to allow those jurisdictions to permit a citizen to be able to participate. And so I thought that was important.
Senator Pugh, let me pull one of our listeners who has called specifically on the question of the stance of the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union. Mm-hmm. Dan in Baltimore is calling us. Dan, welcome to Midday.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. And I want to be really just almost stupidly obvious. Mm-hmm. So the people of Baltimore are, I think your average Baltimorean, and I may be completely mistaken, is intimidated by the police. If you want to make a complaint against any police officer, it's an intimidating process where you have to give a lot of information about yourself and where you live and all these things, which makes it a little bit scary because nobody wants to give that information to complain about a police officer in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The Fraternal Order of Police, they're the union for the police. They're not going to – that's like the American auto workers saying that they want a pay cut and less safety. Mm-hmm. And I want to press. I want to add to this that the police have an incredibly difficult job.
I agree.
And it's scary for them.
Mm-hmm. And so,
what is in this that's really going to make a difference to me, the mm-hmm. Baltimorean mm-hmm. who wants to complain?
Well, let me just say a couple of things. This certainly is not the perfect solution to any of these problems, and I think you're absolutely right that there's fear in the community in many ways of the police, and then there's fear of the police in terms of how they do their jobs. And we hire police officers to protect and serve. You know, and I always tell folks that they can't go knock on your door and ask somebody if they're getting ready to commit a crime. The best they can do is be present and try to prevent crime from taking place by their presence and answer the call when someone calls for help. But when someone wants to complain about the behavior of a police officer, what we're trying to do now is make that complaint process in such a way that people are less intimidated and that they don't have to go through all of these verifications for lodging that complaint. And so I think that, you know, we'll try this process and prayerfully it works better. But more importantly, I think what will come out of this is a need to create a more community policing program in every jurisdiction in the city, where police get to know the community and the communities get to know the police. And I don't know whether you know this though or not, but in several jurisdictions we found where the police forces many of the police officers didn't live in their communities, didn't live in their cities, and we're not saying that you got to live a certain place, but you know, when the mayor, for example, created incentives for police officers to now live in the city and buy homes, I just got through talking to the Board of Realtors, and I said, but, you know, when the average police officer comes out of the academy, they're between the ages of 21 and 24. They're not prepared to buy a home. So is there a way to provide for them lower rents so that they can also live in the city? And because then what happens is they become a part of your community. They are not just your police officer. They're your neighbor. They're your friend. And it helps us to develop a better relationship. But I think when we talk about how do we ultimately change the way we see police and police see us, because I grew up in the days of safety patrols in schools where children took on responsibilities to make sure their schools were safe. And I think when we develop these programs and expand programs beyond the police department, back to police athletic leagues, safety patrols in the schools where you can feel the responsibility of making sure that you have some form of control on a behavior that takes place in your community. And again, we know that even though we had 300-some-odd murders this year, that it's a small group of folks who commit those crimes. But at the same time, the impact that that has on a community and a city and its reputation is great. And so we must do something as it relates to how do we reduce crime in our communities. And that's not about as much about policing as it is about public safety, about lighting up our streets, about creating safer environments, about dealing with the drug problems that are in our neighborhoods, and creating jobs and opportunities for those who don't have them.
Dan, I appreciate your comment. Thank you for calling. Senator Pugh, before I let you go, give me your overall assessment then. You sound very optimistic that the recommendations of your work group are going to be accepted by the state legislature.
Yeah, let me just tell you, I think the thing that we did during this process of several months is, one, it's very inclusive. You know, it's Democrats, it's Republicans, we're across the board in terms of representation, and we didn't just throw out recommendations, we listened to the public. We listened to the police, we listened to the communities, we listened to the advocate groups, we listened to the mothers whose sons have been killed by violence and who suffered, not just by police, but in our communities, who want our cities and our state to be safer. And so I'm optimistic because we had input from so many different aspects of our community. So I'm hopeful that these 23 recommendations will go forward and these committees will deliberate on them and provide us a framework for how we move forward in terms of community policing in this state.
State Senator Pugh, thank you so much for calling us. Thanks.
Thank you.
State Senator Catherine Pugh is co-chair of the Public Safety and Policing Work Group that has made almost two dozen proposals for changes in policing law and standards to the General Assembly. This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis is still with me here in the studio. One of the things that State Senator Pugh talked about was opening up trial boards to the public. You have made, in your press conference last week, you made sort of a step that doesn't go quite as far. You have suggested that you would try to work out a way that a live video of a trial board would be accessible to people who come to the police department in a particular room, as opposed to just opening the door and say, come in.
Right. Well, I would argue, Sheila, that it does go as far. And I applaud Senator Pugh and Delegate Anderson for their leadership in this on this important matter. And some of the changes are long overdue. The notary and the 90 days, those are just silly things that need to be amended, and I look forward to having additional conversations with Senator Pugh. I've already had more than a couple with her and Delegate Anderson to help move this forward. So when I announced a week or so ago, when I introduced my new leadership team, I've made a significant commitment to adding new leaders to the team that oversees any and all things discipline on the Baltimore Police Department. It's a team of five, and they're very impressive credentials, and they're going to get us to a much better place with discipline, morale, and esprit de corps. But when I announced publicly that I intended to open up trial boards for the public to see them while they are occurring live, it's really just a matter of making sure that the administrative hearing board environment, the room where the administrative hearing board is held, doesn't turn into an atmosphere that's not professional or conducive to the hearing. So, for instance, I don't necessarily want a barrage of people from either side and or the media to pack an administrative hearing room to the point where it detracts from the decorum that such a hearing requires. So when I made a public commitment, I'm pretty sure I'm the only police chief commissioner in Maryland to even talk about this, I committed to a live stream in a room that the public can go to and watch. Now, there are some legal hurdles that have to be overcome for this to happen. So the attorneys within the city solicitor, for instance, he and I had a conversation about this. The attorney general may end up having to weigh in on this, but I'm hopeful that the lawmakers in Annapolis can take care of it on their end because their amended legislation can take care of it on its own. So when I was talking about live streaming to a room at the same time, simultaneous to the hearing board, I did that for a specific reason. So the administrative hearing board environment can be conducive to the hearing.
Do citizens serve on those hearing boards?
Not in Maryland. They do not.
Is that a change you think the state legislature should make?
I'm not sure if that's in their 22 recommendations.
I didn't pour it
through there. It's a conversation. It's a conversation that we have to have, and I'm open to having that conversation. Law enforcement is a profession. So what we do is a profession just like other professions, and it requires a degree of expertise to really be able to call balls and strikes. Now, input from the community about our disciplinary system, input about the quality of our internal investigations are all things that I support. My relationship with the CRB and Keisha Brown, for instance, is a strong one, and I intend to work in partnership with her to get the CRB more involved into our process. But it would have to be probably a separate conversation about including, as voting members, citizens on an administrative hearing board. I'm not quite sure that we've had a robust conversation about that yet.
I have lots of questions for Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, but it seems to me that Ralph, who is calling us from Baltimore, has perhaps the most general question. Ralph, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Can I address you as Chief Davis?
Commissioner
sure,
Davis.
Sure.
Yeah, Commissioner Davis. Okay. Yes, and I really hope that you are really interested in solving the problem and the renewing the image of the police. And I want to start with the fraternity. You know, there was a gentleman there that actually, you know, talked about the fraternity of the police. You know, in this community here in Baltimore, the fraternity of the police, has created a very bad image of the police force, because at every turn, when the police do something that is against the how the community should view the police, we always have the police fraternity coming up against the community. The fraternity of the police has never ever stood for justice for people.
Ralph, can I share with you something that you might find interesting, and you probably haven't seen this on the news, but since July 8th, since I took over, we have criminally charged three Baltimore police officers with crimes that were committed on duty. And we were only able to charge in all three cases because other police officers, other Baltimore police officers, Ralph, who were on the scene of those crimes, stood forward and said, "I saw something happen and it wasn't right." So I know that doesn't get as much play in the media. But we have charged three police officers with crimes since July the 8th because other cops have stood up and have identified misconduct. And, you know, that may be a small number. It might be seemingly small, but I think it may run contrary to folks who think that the police aren't capable, one, of policing themselves, and two, of stepping forward when they observe their brother or sister police officer commit a crime. And we are seeing that, and that is encouraging.
Ralph, I appreciate your calling us. Ralph called us at 410-662-8780. You can call, too, if you have a question or a comment for Commissioner Kevin Davis, Baltimore Police Commissioner. Our toll-free number is 661-9309. And you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take a very quick break now, and lots more questions for Commissioner Davis when we come back. I'm Sheila Cass. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking with Police Commissioner Kevin Davis about some of the reforms he's bringing to the Baltimore Police Department. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I wanted to ask you about the investigative report that Jane Miller did on WBAL, looking at complaints filed with the Internal Affairs Division over the past 2.5 years, found that only 9% were deemed worthy of review under the department's internal discipline process. In other words,
Sheila, that's completely inaccurate. What Jane described was that 9% of the investigations concluded with a finding of sustained. So I think, the words have meaning here. So she's talking about cases that were fully investigated, and 9% of all cases that were fully investigated were concluded to be sustained. Therefore, the allegation was proven to have been sustained against the police officer. So there is, sometimes when we talk about how complaints are investigated, they're all investigated. Only 9% concluded with a sustained finding. And that certainly appears to be a number that attracts a lot of attention because it certainly seems low. It seems low to me as well. But they were all investigated. So I don't want to give the impression or the appearance.
I thought sustained meant that complaint then went to further investigation.
It's an investigative finding. Sustained is an investigator. They were all investigated. And I think sometimes when we talk about things, we have to be sure that we're using the correct word.
Sure. Okay.
They're all investigated, and 9% were sustained. And from that, do I think 9% appears to be a low number of sustained investigative findings? I certainly do. And that's why I added significant leadership to my internal affairs team. I brought Vernon Herron in. Vernon Herron was the public safety director in Prince George's County during their Department of Justice consent decree years. I brought in another former internal affairs commander from Prince George's County, who's also an attorney. I stood up a Department of Justice compliance team as soon as I took over in July, so we could ensure that we're fully cooperating with the Department of Justice in their civil rights investigation. So I've added significant attention. I've added internal affairs investigators. And another thing I did is I took the decentralized internal affairs investigators that were stationed at our 9 district stations, and I brought them all in and centralized them under the internal affairs umbrella so we can get better consistency with our investigative findings. So that's where, when you talk about investigative findings, you know, what's the average of sustained police misconduct cases nationally? And is Baltimore below that? Are we at an average? You know, it seems that 9% would be low, and that's something that this leadership team is going to address.
Well, how serious do allegations of misconduct have to be for an officer to undergo, to go to an administrative hearing?
Well, officers in Maryland, and this isn't unique to Baltimore, and I want people to realize that, officers in Maryland, when a case is sustained against them and there's a disciplinary recommendation, and that disciplinary recommendation can be anything, the officer in Maryland has a right to take that case to an administrative hearing board. So it's all cases that have a recommendation of termination automatically go to an administrative hearing board. But any police officer in Maryland can take any investigative recommendation and request a hearing board. That's their right under the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights since 1974.
So that happens once an allegation has been sustained? A complaint has been sustained?
So if a complaint is sustained against a police officer, the police officer can accept it and accept the discipline, and that happens quite frequently. Or a police officer can exercise his or her right to request an administrative hearing board, and that happens occasionally. All investigations that end up with a recommendation of termination, they automatically go to an administrative hearing board.
You mentioned the Justice Department review. Catch us up on where that stands and what it is focusing on.
It's ongoing, and I think people in Baltimore should be proud of the fact that our police department did not wait for the Department of Justice to come back with a finding or a remedy before we stood up our very own Department of Justice compliance team. Again, I've added to that team with a couple people who have experience working with the Department of Justice under consent decrees. So we're not waiting for DOJ or anyone else to get us better or to a better place. We're doing that right now. And I think it's something that the folks in Baltimore should be proud of. We have a team that exclusively interacts with the Department of Justice. They look at best practices. I just created a best practices unit on the police department. That's never existed here before. And I just took the inspections unit in the police department. I moved that out of one of the bureaus, and now they directly report to me in my office.
So why is that important?
Because I want them to expect the things that I think are important. And I don't want there to be any question that when the inspection component of the Baltimore Police Department is out doing their job, that they're doing it on my behalf and at my request. And I think that's important for people to realize.
So how would you describe to people who are not steeped in police department procedure, what is the Department of Justice investigating?
A pattern and practice of civil rights abuses. They do this across the country. If the Department of Justice thinks, or in this instance, the mayor stepped forward and again very progressively asked the Department of Justice to take a look at her police department. So either at the request of a mayor or a governor or a county executive, or the Department of Justice on their own can come in and open up a civil rights investigation if they see what appears to be a pattern and practice of misconduct or civil rights abuses, use of force in particular. It was typically what draws attention of the grabs the attention of the Department of Justice. They'll come in, conduct an investigation. They're doing that right now. So I suspect sometime in 2016 they'll announce their investigative finding.
And you literally don't know whether we're talking 4 months, 6 months, 8 months. You don't know. You think it's going to be sometime this calendar year.
I know, right? That's vague. I do think it's going to be sometime this calendar year. The sooner the better. And we're ready for it. And the Department of Justice would probably tell you that the Baltimore Police Department, recognizing the importance of their investigation, stood up on our very own. No one asked us to do this. No one compelled us to do this. But we stood up our own Department of Justice compliance team. It's led by an attorney, Chief Ganesha Martin, and she has a staff, and they exclusively and solely interact with the Department of Justice.
That is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We have some folks who want to be part of the conversation. Elias is calling us from Arbutus. Welcome to Midday, Elias.
Oh, thank you very much.
Your comment?
I'll try to be succinct about it. The issue is we have the perception of what the law is in the general population, and that depends on how the law is enforced, because people aren't lawyers, you know? We don't see every law that's written. We experience the law by when we get pulled over and when we interact with the police. And I grew up in Homeland. I also went to Poly. So I've been around Baltimore. And the problem is that a lot of people that live in a nice neighborhood like Homeland or Roland Park or Mount Washington, they don't experience the law as it is written. So even when police are following the law, when they arrest people in other neighborhoods that are less fortunate, there's a certain sense in which they are being overly, their presence is being felt far more than in other areas. But if the law was equally applied in those more fortunate areas, people would be completely not okay with it. Because I've heard ex-Baltimore police talk about how you can pull somebody over for almost anything. You can't drive down the street without violating some small rule. And so we have that.
And so your question for Commissioner Davis is whether or not his officers are applying the law equally throughout the city?
No, it's even more nuanced than that. It's that it's not just apply the law equally. People already kind of have a certain sense of this. People know things subtly, but they don't want to admit it to themselves. If he applied the law equally, we would realize we need to change a lot of laws to make it so people can exist and behave normally and not be in trouble for loitering and all these minor crimes. Then, in neighborhoods where those crimes are harshly enforced, legally, not illegally, they create records. We create a perception that those neighborhoods are more crime-ridden. Every time there's an interaction with police, the likelihood of further interaction goes up. You get into the system. It takes something where the law, so we could, it's kind of like the draft. We could equally apply the law and say everybody
Elias,
has to go to the draft.
I think we have the gist of it. I'd like to give Commissioner Davis a chance to share his thoughts on it. Thanks for calling.
I do. I think I have the gist of it, Sheila. And Elias, thank you for your call. And I'm sitting with a proud Poly guy. TJ Smith, our media relations director, is here with me. So I think what you described, and again, this is not unique to Baltimore, and I have the experiences now of leading three different Maryland law enforcement organizations. So as I look at some of the challenges that exist in Baltimore, they exist elsewhere too. So when it comes to fairly applying the law and in the spirit of the law, when it comes down to issuing a simple citation or making an arrest, you know, the question that I always ask is, did the issuance of that citation, did that make society better? That's one of the questions I think police officers have to ask. We don't apply the letter of the law. And arguably what has happened not only in Baltimore but in other big cities with zero tolerance policing tactics, the enforcement of the letter of the law has widened the gap between the police and communities of color. And I think we saw that come to a fine point with the in-custody death of Freddie Gray. So one of the things that I look at written standard operating procedures and policies. So that's one thing, written standard operating procedures and policies. And then I look informally within the organization at standard operating practices. And if there's a gap between your standard operating policies and your standard operating practices, then police leaders know they have some work to do. And we do have some work to do here because our practices shouldn't be different at all from our policies and procedures. So, Elias, if I think I'm hearing you right, we're certainly more than aware of the necessity for improvement. We've got some really talented folks on the Baltimore Police Department, some dedicated, hardworking cops, and we'll get to that place and be a model for our country.
Elias, thanks for the call. We have an email from Dana who asks, Commissioner Davis, what are you doing to support Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell's community policing efforts? It appears he is severely understaffed and underfunded. Are you putting your money where your mouth is?
Well, Dana, I don't know if you've been in Baltimore since July the 8th, but I have given Lieutenant Colonel Mel Russell, who is a very talented leader, been around the BPD since 1979. I consider him a close advisor and important commander. I assigned him about 65 police officers. So before I got here, Dana, Lieutenant Colonel Russ was in charge of 5 or 6 police officers. I centralized the community police officers at the 9 district stations, took them out from underneath the commands of their respective district commanders, and I centralized them all under Lieutenant Colonel Russell. And the division that he's now in charge of is the Community Collaboration Division. Lieutenant Colonel Russell, just like my inspection team, reports directly to me. So I want that unfettered access. Lieutenant Colonel Russell has it. Lieutenant Colonel Russell has brought back Officer Friendly to 9 high schools. He helped put together a summer basketball league. He's a big part of our Outward Bound relationship with young people in the city. And he's helping me, you know, put together our foot patrol curriculum in our academy. And he's helping me with the History of Baltimore speaker series that we're doing. So Lieutenant Colonel Russell, you know, rest assured, Dana, is a big, important part of my team.
Dana, I appreciate the email. Commissioner Davis, at your press conference last week, you said the department needs to, quote, do more to improve the health and wellness of police officers, close quote. Are you talking about mental health?
And physical health. You know, we just buried a police officer who, 48 years old, who suffered a heart attack and died. We buried a police officer a couple months ago at the most because of suicide. The most deadly killer of cops in America is suicide. So we don't do enough to ensure that the mental health and well-being of police officers is what it should be. And if you look at, you know, the President Obama's pillars in his 21st century task force recommendations, he speaks specifically about the health and well-being of police officers. Police officers deal with persons, families, and communities that are in a constant crisis. And I would argue that police officers see more in a week than most people see in a lifetime when it comes to other people in crisis. And so their emotions are always on a roller coaster doing this job, particularly in Baltimore. And that emotional toll has a physical and mental effect on police officers, and we have to recognize that and do a better job at getting them help.
How?
We need to have some in-house psychological services components. We need to improve that. We need more peer-to-peer counseling. We need to take advantage of our chaplains more often, and we just need to recognize that it's not only at the beginning of a police officer's career that we should be concerned about their psychological well-being and mental fitness. We need to be concerned about those things throughout the course of their career. And that's something specifically that I've spoken to Senator Pugh about. You know, what are we doing to ensure the psychological wellness of our police officers? We can't just be concerned about it before we decide to hire them and put them in a police academy. We have to build in steps along the way throughout their career, career development, to ensure that we're paying attention, because it's that police officer who, unbeknownst to us, is crying out for help that often finds himself or herself in a situation that embarrasses the organization detracts from the police community relationship.
We have just a minute left, and I can't let you leave without asking about homicides. 344 homicides last year, 11 so far in January. Is anything changed?
We always look at year to year and month to month. So January of 16 versus January of 15, we're having a better January. So it's one day at a time. It's 1 hour at a time. We have closed 50% of our homicides in 2016, and we've closed them with community help. And that's really important for folks to hear. We're closing it because the community is stepping up, helping us close these cases.
We'll stop on that note. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. And thank you to our listeners, and thank you to Dangerously Delicious Pies. They provided lunch today for our midday guests. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street, on the Square in Canton, and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Stay tuned to Here and Now, and tomorrow, as we get a portrait of youth homelessness in Maryland. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been with us. See you tomorrow.